Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world. On the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, all the excitement of the British general election is over, and now we have the aftermath, and the pollsters were proved completely wrong in the election, and the Conservative Party got in, doesn't have to be in coalition anymore, and the three main opposing parties, I guess you could call them, Labour, the Liberal Democrats, and UKIP, that new force in British politics, their leaders have all quit, and we're moving into a whole new era. What does that say to us, and why am I saying this to you now? It proves that no matter how certain you may be about the way things may go, you may well be wrong. Everybody was sure that there would be what we call in the United Kingdom a hung parliament, where no one party would have a majority, and deals would have to be done to get a government together. And in the end, that didn't happen. Very definitively, what a strange period this has been, but what also an exhausting period for a lot of us have been. So I'm a little behind on things here at The Unexplained, so there won't be any shout-outs on this edition. I've got hundreds of emails to collate, and I always make little notes on them when I do the shout-outs, so I need to do that. So we'll do that on the next edition when I've caught up with life, the world, and everything, which I will have done hopefully in a week or so. Thank you very much for all of the emails, the nice things, the guest suggestions, and the donations. Please keep those coming. Go to the website, www.theunexplained.tv. The website devised, created, maintained by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. There you can leave a donation or you can send me a message. We spoke on the last edition with Duncan Rhodes from Nexus magazine, and he mentioned Tricia McKay, the animal communicator from Australia, who I spoke to on radio 10 years ago. She's in Perth, Western Australia, and I've looked her up, and she's going to be on this edition, and she has some truly amazing things to say. A favourite guest. I hope you like her too. So she's coming up in just a second. Thank you for your emails. Please, if you can make a contribution to this show, please do so, if that is possible. It is massively helpful to the running of this show. And if you want to send me a message, give me some thoughts on the show, tell me how I can do it better, suggest a guest, you can do that. I have a long, long list of guest suggestions that I'm working through. And, you know, over time, we will get to them. The aim, of course, always, is for me to expand this show and do more of them. At the moment, to make some money, I have to go out and work. And, you know, fitting everything in is sometimes difficult. And making ends meet, as it is for many of us, is also difficult. But that's my life, and I'm not going to bore you with it. The weather turning here. Promise not to talk about the weather for too long, by the way, in case you don't like that kind of thing. But we're into springtime now, and I'm breathing a big sigh of relief. We're here at last. Okay, let's get to the animal communicator now, Tricia McKay in Perth, Western Australia. Tricia, lovely to have you on The Unexplained again.
Oh, you're very welcome.
What an absolute blast to have you on, because the last time we talked was on TalkSport Radio across the UK. Guess how long ago it was, Tricia? It was 10 years.
Oh, my God. That is a long time, isn't it?
But the strange thing is that you haven't changed at all. You seem to be getting younger.
Oh, you're wonderful. That's why I love your show.
You see, you've got to keep the guests happy. That's what it's all about. Perth, Western Australia, wonderful place. And I know that you're into the autumnal time of year now, as we're moving into spring and then into summer. But how's the weather looking in Perth?
Oh, sunny as usual. It doesn't rain much here, actually, Howard. And it's beautiful, about 24 degrees.
Very nice. And we're getting something like that up here. But of course, then we should at this time of year here. Down there, I remember being down there doing a show for Capital Radio. I think it was about 1999, maybe 2000 that I was down there. And we stayed in the Burswood Resort Hotel, and it was about 38 degrees going up on 40 degrees. And it really was. It was beautiful, but it was hot.
Yes, oven hot, isn't it? It's not humid, just oven hot. But, you know, that's pretty common in our summer over here. It really is. It can get up to 45.
But listen, doing what you do and communicating with animals and understanding them, I can't think of many places better in this world than Perth, because you have an amazing variety of wildlife there, stuff that we don't see here. And even on Rottnest Island, which is very close to you and which we went to, in fact, we broadcast from there, you even have a unique creature, don't you, on Rottnest Island?
Yes, called quokkas.
Yeah. They're like a little, how would we describe? He's like a little vole, isn't he?
Yes, very much so. They're very small but very cute, and people just love them when they go and visit them on Rottnest Island. Well, that's why I think it was originally maybe called Ratnest Island, because they resembled sort of the rat.
And I think I'm right in saying that the little quokkas, which are unique to Rottnest Island, which is only a couple of miles offshore from Perth, they're protected now, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes, very much so. They need to be, though, because, you know, as usual, things happen. But it's a beautiful island, and they certainly make the island what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm glad they're protected, because we did meet a couple of guys who worked on the island there. They thought it was really funny. They were talking about playing quokka soccer. They were kicking them, which we were just, you know, being British, and we care about animals here, and so we should. Back then, we were appalled by that. It was just not not good. And I hope that kind of thing doesn't go on anymore.
Well, it does a little bit, but they're certainly cracking down on that, Howard, which I'm really happy about as well, you know, because no animal deserves that, especially quokkas. They're very defenceless. And really, they're on the island first. We're the invaders. Yep. So we need to respect that.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about, really. Respect for and communication with the animal kingdom. You know, our perception, it seems to me, of animals and what they know and their place in the hierarchy, I think, has changed enormously in the last 20 years. You know, we used to use phrases in the UK like dumb animals and that sort of stuff. And of course, they can't speak to us in words like you and I do. But that's not to say that they can't communicate, is it?
No. There's a silent language that all species use. And, you know, we're just another species. So we can actually tap into that silent communication, which is what I do. We were all born with it. And then we started to verbalize, and we kind of lost, or, you know, forgot the skill. And then I just was reawakened to it many years ago and realized that I could still tap into that form of communication.
How were you reawakened to it, Tricia?
Well, basically, look, I love animals, as probably you do, but I had two cats at the time, and one of the cats became very ill and was taken to the vet and was put on a life support machine. And, you know, I really loved this cat, and I remember, you know, putting my face on his face and, you know, just holding his paw and telling him that, you know, come on, keep fighting, you can do it, you can do it. And just so clearly I heard, you have to let me go. You have to set me free. And it was the absolute opposite to what I was saying and thinking, you know. And I was devastated at the time, thinking, oh, what am I thinking? And realizing it wasn't mine. It was actually coming from Bo, my cat. And that was a really turning point moment in my life, as I was the only one in the room. And you could hear that. And then after that, you know, obviously I did set him free. I had to have him euthanized, which is very unfortunate. I was very in love with Bo. But days and weeks after that, just every time I came across an animal, I started to hear their conversation.
Right. There would be people for whom this is a stretch of credulity, but I very much understand what you're talking about. When you talk about them conversing between themselves, how does that work? Because is it rational thoughts in the form of sentences that we would use, or is it perceptions of how they're feeling and where they're at?
Look, every animal will have a different conversation, same as we have, because we have a different lifestyle and things like that. These animals, I mean, you know, you're not necessarily going to get a predator and prey wanting to speak to each other for obvious reasons, but they will communicate in the way that they need to at the time. Now, there's lots of other forms of communication, you know, lions roar, dogs bark, and these have been developed also to make it a bit more verbal and so that they can create more group settings. But we're talking about the one-on-one. So they will talk in forms of how they come to me, their visuals. So if another animal needs to show another animal, a place, location, or something of relevance, they will do that. I mean, the indigenous people all over the world found water holes and food sources from doing this with animals. So the animals in turn can do it with each other. But as I say, they don't, you know, just chat like we do for no reason. You know, there is a very desired purpose. And going back to, perhaps people with a degree of skepticism. You know, Howard, I my background is in dentistry, and so I graduated from university, and so I've come from a very left brain type of scenario. So to have this happen to me actually blew my mind as well. So I can perfectly understand people going, what? How can that be? Well, that's what I thought as well. And when it kept happening, I then went on to research it and found out there was many animal communicators around the world and teaching other people to do it, which is what I do. So, yeah, it was amazing. So that the phenomena that was coming up and people say, well, how did you know? You know, well, you know, because the information that you're getting from the animal, you can't possibly know. This is information maybe only the person knows about, or sometimes I use it to discover various things about animals without looking it up and looking it up afterwards, you know. So there's lots of degrees of relevance here.
There are so many things I want to ask you and talk with you about on this subject, but one of these things is all the things that you just discussed, that you've just talked about. Do they explain why there are some people in this world who we just think are good with animals? I mean, dogs seem to have a great affinity with me. I can be walking, I live near a park, and I can maybe be walking amongst other people, but the dogs will make a beeline for me. And that is invariable. It happens all the time. And I do love dogs, and I like to think that I empathize with them. I've never quite understood how. Is this what we're talking about? Am I doing what you do but not knowing it?
Look, most people who have animals at home are all doing it and not realizing it. They're not being able to decipher between their thoughts and their animals. But also, animals are very keen and easily work with energy. Now, Howard, people who love animals and have this compassion towards them just have a certain type of energy, even a colour of their aura that the animals recognise. It's almost like you've got animal lover written on your forehead. And also, you know, when you see them, the look on your face, and they can read your thoughts. That's what this conversation is all about. They can read your thoughts. That's how, you know, people like Dr. Rupert Sheldrake and very many other people say, well, how does a dog know when you're coming home and it's a different type, a different route, and so on and so on? Well, they can tap into to our thoughts. So your thoughts must be very lovely of them as well. You know, you might see a dog and go, oh, how beautiful is that dog, or I really love them. And all of those thoughts, they pick up and they know immediately. They also know, cats are really good at this, when people don't like them, and they make sure that they have a very close encounter with them to try to prove their point.
I'll tell you my dog story very quickly. When I was a teenager, we had a yellow Labrador, a golden Labrador, some people call them, called Nishka. And Nishka and I, we used to go on long walks, and we really got on. And she would go nuts just before I was due to get home from school. She would know. She'd be sitting in the porch waiting for me. Even if I was delayed or if my schedule was different that day, she would know. And the funniest story about Nishka of all, and I've never quite understood how this was, my late mother always used to make the Christmas dinner for us. And you know, up here, they make a big, literally a big meal, a big deal out of Christmas dinner. It's such a big thing. So my mother used to prepare all of this stuff, the turkey and the sprouts and everything. And I know you shouldn't feed dogs this kind of thing, but this is a previous era where we didn't really understand this. And, you know, Nishka wasn't complaining. We always gave her a little bit of, you know, of the Christmas dinner, the gravy and all the rest of it. And my mother prepared a plate for her. She'd been sitting waiting patiently for it. And she ran towards it because, of course, dogs and food, we know that relationship. And my mother just said to her in words, and this sort of stuff happened all the time, happened with me all the time. My mother said to her, I wouldn't eat it now if I were you because it's very hot. And she stepped back and sat down and waited. My mother just said that to her. How did she know that?
Because people don't realise that every time, like, we're talking to each other now, Howard, but we're actually visualising things as well. Like, you might, when you said to me earlier, oh, what's it like in Perth? So even if I'm not looking out my window, I'm getting a visual in my mind. Oh, there's sunny. I can see the ocean, you know, from where I am and things like this. Well, your mother would be doing that also, you know, because she would be giving, internally in her mind, she might be showing things of touching something and it'd be very hot, or just the impression of the heat, the energy of it. And so the animal is thinking, oh, that's not good. So all of these things happen, and we've done various studies on this and in various workshops and just you know, separate research ourselves, and this has happened a lot. I mean, a lot. You know, we were at a horse clinic the other day working with all these horses, and we just sat there in a group, and this horse was just grazing, and I said, okay, let's just do an experiment. We're all going to telepathically call that horse's name and ask him to look up at us. And we did it, and this horse was trying to get back to his grazing, but he just looked straight up at us within seconds. And he hadn't done that for the last half an hour. So we are constantly doing these things to show that, you know, these animals do pick this up. And that's why, you know, various times your animal knows when you're going to do something, or your dog will get all excited and you haven't even taken the lead out yet. You haven't even walked towards the door yet. But in your mind, you're picturing where you're going to walk.
Now, how strange you should mention that, because my greatest story about Mishka, an amazing animal, and I still miss her tremendously. I used to take her for walks. We lived near a beach north of Liverpool, and we had lovely sandy beaches there and a beautiful view of the mountains of North Wales across the River Mersey and beyond. And she used to love the smell of the sea. All dogs do, I think. And she couldn't wait to go for a walk. So we told her we were going for a walk. So she stood by the front door waiting, tail going bang, 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 bang. And it was cold. You know, it's often cold in the UK, and especially where I was brought up. I had to go and get my coat, a nice warm coat from upstairs. And I went upstairs and she started to cry because she thought I was not going to go on the walk. And I just said to her, look, I'm just going to get my coat. And she sat down quietly and waited for me. Now, you know, all of those things, they're funny stories, but they prove to us that there is communication.
Look, absolutely, and there is communication. And, you know, the various people that, like you mentioned earlier about people who work with animals, you know, do they have this communication going on? Absolutely. You know, there was Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter from Australia, and various people that work with animals, and they are already communicating. They are doing it, but on a subconscious level. And I remember a guy who came from Australia and he went over to Hong Kong, and in the first few months that he was there, all the horses that he was training started to win, and everybody was wondering. And I remember him going on the news, and we were watching it over here in Australia, and he said, oh, I don't know. He said, all I know is that I just give the horses what they want. And it was really interesting, because to know what they want, he was in a way communicating with them, giving them what they needed, and the horse was respecting that backwards. So the horses were happy. So they were running well. And this is just happening even without him realizing. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, oh my God, he's doing amazing communication with those horses.
Now, that has implications for us too, as human beings, because we are no less animals than the animals. Presumably, we are communicating on this level as well, which I've always believed, but it's part of the same thing, is it?
It is part of the same thing. You've heard, Howard, you know, when people with partners, they can finish the sentence, you know, their sentences and things like that, or they just know what they're thinking. I've tried this too with my husband on various occasions, and, you know, I asked him, of course, before I do it, and tried out various experiments, and it works. And I was even with children, you know, I might be standing in a queue and there might be a very small child, because remember, they're just out of the birth process. So they're very much into this silent language before they start to verbalize. And I've actually, telepathically communicated with the child and asked them to maybe turn around in the queue, and I might be six people back. And the child has turned around and looked at me. And it's really amazing. And they've documented this with mothers, you know, how a mother can be in a different room and then all of a sudden just know they have to be with their baby and something's happening, because this telepathic communication is indeed going on.
Mm. Which has all sorts of implications for each and every one of us, if only we will listen to that non-verbal communication and understand that it could potentially benefit us.
Well, it can. I'm not so sure. We always want to know what people think of us, Howard. That could be rather daunting, going to a party with a few drinks. But but certainly the reason we don't do it as much, look, we are different to the animals in the respect of that we have agendas, and we're a little bit more cautious, and we've had different things go on with other humans, so we're a little bit more wary. That's why with medications we can have placebo effects and things like that, whereas animals can't. If you try a medication on an animal, it either works or it doesn't. They don't have this other agenda. So that's where it differs a little bit. But however, the reason the animals can do it so well, they're telepathic geniuses, is because they don't have the verbal language other than, you know, their verbal cues, meaning, you know, barking or whatever else. They don't have that. They've been using this silent language from day dot, from right from the beginning. It's us who've kind of forgotten about it. And then because of computers and technology, we're all overstimulated. So we've forgotten how to be quiet. And that's what the animals know, and what I'm actually teaching people to do is to get touch with them, back in touch with that quietness and themselves by just being. And once they do that, they are really in touch with nature again. And that is why the animals, when the tsunamis came in 2004, the wild animals weren't hurt. Those elephants, many of the animals were up that hill and onto dry land an hour and a half before it hit, because they are much more in tune with everything and nature that goes on in the planet. They're not as stimulated.
Right. I mean, this is seismic, very, very important stuff, I think, for all of us. There are many, many news stories that are run as funny stories often by the newspapers up here, and I'm sure there too, Tricia, about situations like quite recently there was a farmer, I'm sure you're probably going to know the story I'm going to tell you, but a farmer who was under threat, I think, from a raging bull, and the cows in the field made a ring around the farmer to protect him from the threat. The dynamic of that situation, fascinating.
Absolutely. And you probably would have heard, and it's happened in a couple of different places, actually, but we'll talk about the one in near New Zealand, where there was a man who was threatened by, I think it was a white pointer shark, and a ring of dolphins. They formed a ring around him as well. So there was about five dolphins that formed a ring around him and actually protected him. And another in the Red Sea, where a diver was actually being attacked by a shark, and the dolphin actually nose-butted it until it went away. So he looked after that man as well. So these are really remarkable stories.
I've been to many places in this world where there are sharks, and I have encountered sharks. I've even encountered a baby shark who was taken out of the ocean in Durban, South Africa. He was being weighed and tagged and checked by the people who do shark research there, the Natal Sharks Board. And they brought him out of the ocean, and he wasn't very big. And I could just feel from him that he felt almost demeaned to be the king of the ocean and to have been taken out by these people and being weighed and prodded and tested before being gently led back into the water and floated off. I just got this feeling of, you know, what a waste of my time this is.
Well, funny you should say that, because, Howard, honestly, that's what happens in a lot of those cases, because it's just something we humans feel that we need to do, whether it be for research or finding out or tracking a shark or wanting to know what they do. But you see, their view of everything is that, and when I've communicated with whales and sharks and, you know, various animals, their view is that we are all on the planet together and we all just live in harmony. There's no need for all of this. You know, there's no need, because the reason we're doing this often is because we want to go in the ocean. I mean, Perth, Western Australia, mainly Australia, but certainly Perth, WA is being known for the shark capital, you know. There's a lot of shark attacks, unfortunately.
Haven't you had a spate of those recently?
Yes, we have. And look, there's various reasons, I'm sure, for that, and also because we've mixed up the equilibrium of certain numbers of sharks as well, because some are protected, some aren't, and some are involved in from long distances away with humans and food and our climatic changes, various things. But certainly here we're getting that. But we have to remember that sharks cannot live on land. They have to live in the water. It is us that has the choice. And I think if we make that choice, we have to take that risk. We can't kill off all the sharks or kill off something that's just not suiting us on a hot day, you know, because that's where they live. And they're not rogue sharks out to kill us. They're merely doing what they need to do. They're just being a shark. And if we're at the wrong place, wrong time, or they feel a threat, or, you know, if we were starving, we would probably take that need as well, if that was what the reason for the shark was doing it. So, you know, I think we've just got to be a little bit more with a wider viewpoint of other beings on this planet other than ourselves.
Is it possible, if you find yourself, and we know that sharks tend to attack surfers because the boards, certainly in the experience that I've had in South Africa and Perth and places like that, the boards look like a shark to a shark. You know, they want to attack a rival. They don't know who that person invading their territory is. If we learned better communication, do you think that we might even be able to defuse a shark attack, a potential shark attack?
Well, look, it's always possible, Howard, but, you know, I remember being asked a question like this if I encountered a lion in Africa. There's two points to this. When the animal is calm and in a receptive mode, the same as we are, when we're both communicating on that level. There's also another level, which is the planetary version, which means they do get into their species. So if they are in a heightened mode, the same as in a, if your dog is really well trained, but all of a sudden they see a snake or they see something to chase, it's very hard to get them back because we have to break that mode, if you know what I mean. If that mode was broken, I would say yes. But when it comes right down to survival, whether you live or die, that may not be what's on your mind, is the communication, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and you're not going to be able to have a rational dialogue with them. That's not how this would ever work.
No, unless you were in a correct situation. But having said that, I do also know of people who have communicated with snakes that have reared up and about to bite, and they have actually communicated with them, and the snake has stopped, and the snake has turned and walked and slithered away. So that's, and I know that from people I know personally. You know, a few of those occasions. So you know, I would say, you know, and depending on how life and death it is, the situation for the animal as well, or if it feels cornered, because it still has its instinctual side to it. There's many levels of communication, Howard, and you know, certainly the instinctual one would come on the personality level and the planetary level. And then of course there's the life purpose, which is why our animals are with us. You know, why was Mishka with you at that particular time in your life for that many years? There's certainly that. There's a global thing where we have like a group element of, you know, all lions versus, you know, all snakes or all sharks. You know, what is their purpose here? What do they do here? That type of thing. So there's sort of very many different levels to think about.
There are some TV programs here, and I don't want to trivialise any of this, but they're very entertaining. You may have seen them. Austin Stevens, The Snake Man?
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay, well, Austin Stevens is a South African guy. He takes photographs of snakes, goes all over the world, including Australia and America and South Africa, where he's from, to find and photograph and catalogue snakes. And he goes, there was one particular episode where he went down a tunnel where the snakes were sheltering from the peak of the daytime sun. And the tunnel was full of deadly snakes. And the tunnel was only person-sized, so you could literally just crawl along it with a camera. And that was the only space there. The only way out of it was to back yourself out of it, slowly. And I thought, this man is a lunatic. He is going to be killed there. And indeed, the snakes were there, and they reared up and looked at him. And they seem to sense, because he is very earnest in his research and has produced some excellent programs. You know, I wouldn't do, we have a saying in Liverpool, I wouldn't do what he does for a big clock. You know, you know, I that timepiece I don't want. I just don't know how he does it. But they seem to understand, and they let him take his pictures and slowly make his way out of there. They could have killed him in a heartbeat, and they didn't.
But there's two elements of that again, and I've seen this over and over and over again. His energy would not have been threatening at all. He would have gone in there with exploration and wanting to film them and wanting to bring that to light for people. He would have had a great intention. Animals are all about intention. So if he's gone in there, and he's not a hunter, he's clearly not a hunter, and they would have known that, because animals are very instinctual. And that's why they know when your intention's not good. That's why if somebody comes to the door and your dog is really wanting to attack this person and it's totally out of character, you might want to think about that person, right? Because the energy's not right. Now, that's the first thing. And then, you know, the second thing is that animals do want us to be aware of them, and they want us to show you their other side, you know, because snakes have a really bad rap a lot of the time, Howard. You know, they're always known as people killers, or they're dangerous, and most people are scared of them. I mean, some of the workshops I do, even around here in Australia, I work out at some of the zoos, and one of the zoos has a boa constrictor in the room. You know, people freak out. They're going, that snake's not going to come out, is it? I mean, nobody's going to take it out. No, nobody's going to take it out. We're just going to communicate with the snake. And this snake is amazing because he loves us there. They have a lot of corporate people in the room at other times. But when we have our workshop there, this snake actually, when we get in the zone of the snake actually comes down. The keeper said they've never seen him do it with anyone else. And the snake will come down, and then sometimes it'll just be looking at all of us and sort of sliding from side to side. And it's just amazing. We just love it, you know? I mean, that is just really something that shows you that we have a wonderful intent and just want to communicate with him, and he feels completely comfortable with us, which is wonderful.
A lot of my animal stories come from my days on the radio in London, and I was lucky enough to do a lot of things and go a lot of places. We did a show one morning from the London Aquarium, which is an amazing thing to visit. And we were able to go into the London Aquarium before it was open to the public, and I was given a microphone and a long lead, and I went to stand by the tank full of rays. And I like rays. I don't know why, but they just have, for me, they have a nice energy about them. And there was one that was so curious about me. He kept coming to the side of the tank and just looking at me and flapping around. And I thought, well, you are lovely. And I don't know what you're trying to say to me. Anyway, when I finished the broadcast and I was walking away from the tank, this particular ray leapt out of the tank. Now, if you can imagine, this guy was the size of, I don't know, like a very large shop carrier bag. That's a bad example, but he was a big, big guy. And there he was flapping around on the floor. And there was no keeper around or anybody like that. And it is quite an experience to get a ray back into a tank. You know, they're not the lightest of creatures. But I just always wondered, it's been, how many years ago did that happen? Probably 13 years ago. I've been wondering for all of those 13 years, what on earth was that about?
Wow. Well, he really didn't want you to leave, did he? He was enjoying your company. I have two friends who they got married about a year ago, and they have a Saratoga fish. I don't know whether you know what that looks like, but it's in an aquarium, and they bought it, you know, fairly small, but it's around, you know, sort of 30 centimetres now. No, nearly 60 centimetres. So that's quite a large fish we're talking about. And ever since they got married, the fish hasn't been happy because he has manned up and got quite bonded with the guy, Max. And so every time, if she walks too close to the tank, it's got a top on it, but this fish will come going at it, screaming at a rate of knots, coming out through the top of it and landing on her chest. And the fish has done that three times, and they've reinforced it three times, but the fish still comes out and lands on her chest. So she gives the aquarium now a wide berth. And every female who comes there, including me, I went over to the tank, and of course he followed me up and down, and then I just gave him a bit of a death stare, and he kind of backed off, you know. But he's really, it's quite obvious that he just wants to be friends with Max, and, you know, he doesn't want anything to break that friendship. So it's been very interesting.
We have, where I live, and I don't want this to just become stories, but they are fascinating and rather lovely a lot of the time. I live near one of Her Majesty's Royal Parks, in which there are deer, which belong, like everything in the Royal Parks, to Her Majesty the Queen, and they're not allowed to be harmed in any way, and their population is controlled, and they're kept on the straight and narrow, and they're fed in the winter when the grass freezes over. The deer there are fascinating. You find a lot of the time the young deer in the heat of the day all gather together. It's almost like being in the Serengeti or somewhere. And they're a little shy of people, even though they see people and people on bikes all the time here, because this is London. But they're, you know, they worry about people, and they don't like people walking dogs because some people are stupid with their dogs and some people try to feed them and all sorts of ridiculous things that still happen. But I tend to find when I walk past them, I will say, "Good afternoon, guys. Everything okay? Hope it is. Warm today, isn't it?" You know, and nobody's around. They can't hear me saying this. And I just say to them, when they look at me, as much to say, "Are you a threat?" And I just say, "Look, I'm having a nice walk in the park, and I think you look lovely, and I'm not going to harm you." And they don't bother. They flick their tails and, you know, bash off a couple of flies. You know, they get rid of a couple of flies from their bodies, and they just lie down again, and everything's fine. It is remarkable how all of that works.
I can perfectly understand then why the animals love you being around, Howard, because that's the perfect scenario for every animal. And I know that people listening to this, I know people out there are talking to their animals, because a lot of my clients do. They might do it in the privacy of just themselves, but they certainly do talk with animals. But it is a serious thing around the world because, you know, humans seem to think that, you know, we kind of dominate things and, you know, it's all got to suit us and this sort of thing. I think the awareness now is changing, like you said, especially in the last few years, where animals are gaining importance in some areas and still need a lot more importance in other areas. But certainly to do with our domestic animals, they're now family members. They become not partners as such, but people who live on their own. They become wonderful companions. People see them as family members now, not the years ago where you had the dog that used to just sit outside and, you know, so on and so on. So that in effect has changed. But the problem we're having now is that, you know, we're talking about rays. In the Cayman Islands, you know, it's a bit like the paparazzi on celebrities. You know, these poor rays, they don't get very much break from the divers and various people who visit them there. So they've found that their immune system is actually dropping and they're having physiological difficulties, as are the king penguins in the Antarctic, and that their heart rate actually goes up when they see humans. So we've got to be very aware of the effect that we're having on animals around the planet and that they have as much right to be here as us. And we can learn a lot from them in, you know, harmonising and having a symbiotic relationship with each other, even predator and prey. There's a very great amount of respect even there, even in Africa and Asia, various parts of the world within the animal kingdom. I think we have a lot to learn, and I think that we need to just humble ourselves a little bit and say, you know, these animals are very important. Because Howard, I say to anybody, could you imagine if there was no animals on the planet? Because if we took all the humans off the planet, the planet would still thrive. But if we took all the animals off, the planet would die, because they're crucial to everything that is on this planet.
And that's a humbling and a sobering thought, isn't it, Tricia?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Did you know Steve Irwin?
Not personally, but I did know a lot of his work. Mm. Which was great, yeah. And I know, and he was actually, unfortunately, killed by a ray.
Well, I wanted to try and get a handle on how that happened. This man who was so at one with the animals and did so much for the animal kingdom and was loved around the world. Ironic, wasn't it, that he had his end in that way? And I wonder what went wrong in the communication there. Something must have.
Well, something would have, and I you know, without, you know, speculating, it would have been great to actually connect with that particular stingray. But I would imagine it has something to do with his purpose, that perhaps Steve, it was his time for some reason on whatever level he wanted to do that. And really, what a fitting way to go out for someone like Steve Irwin. I mean, you can't imagine Steve Irwin going out and getting run over by a car, or, you know, he was in wildlife and perhaps he got a little too close, or he just pressed the boundaries that little bit too much, and it just happened that way. There was something that, you know, didn't occur. But I don't even feel that. I feel it was just something between him and nature, and for some reason this was his time. I don't think there was a demise involved, you know, like to do with the ray or to do with him. But certainly to have and show the rest of the world that there is a very big respect for you when you work with wild animals and you're in their domain, you need to respect that, which I believe Steve would have done. But just to show the rest of us what possibly could happen. And Steve might have been instrument in showing us that, you know, unfortunately with his life. But I think, you know, what he gave to the planet and what he gave us regarding the animals was truly amazing. And I think he also showed people to have a very, very healthy respect when you're in another environment.
In South Africa, there's a man called Kevin Richardson who's made the papers a great deal because of his life literally with the lions. He, you know, sleeps with them, is constantly around them and always has been, and has a unique, which I've seen. I've actually been to the park that he ran. Now he's got other enterprises and operations out there. His rapport with them is remarkable. They regard Kevin as one of them in a way that I've never really understood. If I went into any of the cages there, as much as I love those creatures, especially the white lions, which have a special majesty and peace about them, but if I went in there, you know, I would be lunch pretty quickly, I would have thought. Kevin goes in there and they put their paws over his shoulder and they greet him as if he's just one of them. They don't seem to sense that he hasn't got the defences and the aggressive capability that they have. They just regard Kevin as another lion.
But they don't need to, really, because he is one of them. He has become one of them. I do know of Kevin Richardson, and I actually worked in Africa myself, and I went in those enclosures with adult lions, and we worked with them and became part of the pride. And every day we would go out walking in the wild. There was no constraints or restraints on them. We just walked freely with them, and they saw us as part of their pride. And that is what we could do with every animal. Kevin's shown us, Steve's shown us, there's so many people around the world that you've just got to love and respect an animal. I've even with domestic animals, somebody said, oh, I've got a Siberian husky. They're quite wild. They're a bit like a wolf. And they said, you know, this animal's just really afraid when people come over and this, that, and the other thing. I mean, I was with that dog only a matter of minutes, and he was quite timid. So I just got down on all fours. And all of a sudden, he just treated me completely differently. We were then like mates, and even the person, if I visit them now, they said, you know, you're the one and only person that can come here like every few months or once a year, and that dog just loves and respects you and treats you so differently to everybody else. And I said, because I am not overbearing, I am not trying to be a master over the dog, I am simply saying, hey, really, I'm just another species. And that's what these guys are doing too. That's what we did with the lions in Africa that we worked with. I worked with vultures. I was in an enclosure with about 20 vultures. None of those animals were a threat or anything else, because they knew of our intention, and also because we felt they're equal. We weren't above them. And in fact, I feel a lot of the time the animals and the way they conduct themselves are actually above us. And that's how I'm very humble around animals, and I'm very privileged to be doing their work, hopefully, around Australia and around the world, and educating people into a new way of thinking and a new perception of working with animals and how intelligent they are and how they're such amazing silent observers, and they know so much about us, Howard, more than we know about ourselves, and that is what is so beautiful.
You get no arguments about that from me, Tricia. What do you make of the almost veneration that some New Age people, in inverted commas, have for dolphins? What do you sense about all of that? Is that misplaced or well placed?
Look, I think it can be both. I think it can be both. I think it can be well placed, because look, the nature of dolphins is actually very healing. We have a lot of, I'm not sure about the UK, but we have elements here where they actually use dolphins to heal people, you know, disabled children and various things. So they're actually great healers. And even that we were talking earlier about, you know, saving people in the water from sharks and various things, they have a nature of love and calmness. And I think that the dolphin has been put in that light in various ways, and that's why I think the New Age people always say about the dolphins, and also because they work in groups and they're very harmonious. So, you know, probably a little bit of both. I personally don't think dolphins are any more than the whale, you know, for instance, or any more than, say, an albatross. You know, there's all of the animals to me have a remarkable place here, and are all amazing healers. The horse clinic I was mentioning earlier, I haven't worked with these horses, particular horses, before, and we just took some chairs down to the paddock. We sat down so I could teach the people how to just be. Well, the horses had an idea of their own, and they began healing people. And they would go up to people, lower their heads, lower their eyes, and they would just absolutely instill people with this amazing energy. And so I just let them do their stuff. And they're not healing horses. They're just horses. But animals all have this ability and are willing to give to us if we just allow it.
Rather like, and it's made news up here, probably around the world recently, the ability of dogs to sniff out cancer.
Yes, yes. Well, the dogs, look, dogs are amazing creatures, Howard. They can sniff out cancers, but they do so much other work for us as well. You know, when people are missing, you know, they can find bodies. They help with the fire people. They help the police. Dogs are so willing to give. I think if we could be half as giving as a dog, it would be amazing. And they do have amazing skills. And, you know, if you look at the cosmetics and you look at everything we use, which I am not in agreement with, where an animal is harmed or killed in any way just for our, you know, looks or, you know, gain. But most of the things on this planet are to do with animals. Nearly everything is to do with an animal. Nearly every product is to do with an animal because each one has an amazing ability. It's just a pity we just don't use it in the correct way and that everybody benefits from it. Unfortunately, the animals usually come out second best.
Do you think the animals have on any level, perhaps they don't because they exist more on instinct, but do they have on any level a sense of despair for what we're doing to our planet?
Look, absolutely. And a good example of that is the way the whales are beaching. And I remember connecting with the whales and they said, we're quite happy to sacrifice ourselves to show what's happening in the waters, for instance. And they said, your scientists were looking at things but now they've sort of come to the arrangement that, you know, it's just kind of some sonar that goes off and they try to put the whales back in, which is lovely, all those beautiful volunteers around the world trying to put the whales back into the water. But the whales have informed me that they're going to take sharks and dolphins with them in the future because they need the scientists to relook and we need to reevaluate what we're doing on this planet. And that's just one species. And there has been cases that have been known around the world where sharks have been beached or there has been a dolphin in that group. So what they've told me is actually happening. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in the future. Unfortunately, I don't think we're changing many of our ways to stop that particular thing. And so they are very much on various levels trying to show us how we're ruining the planet, you know, whether it be from the bees disappearing because, you know, there's been a lot of research into genetically modified plants and, you know, other aspects, other animals disappearing because, you know, things that we really need on this planet, they're disappearing because of the way the planet's being treated. So I think in a lot of ways they are very much doing that.
I had some years ago on a holiday in Devon, which, you know, is a very beautiful rural part of the UK. It has everything. It has great rolling fields and hills and beautiful ocean. I had an encounter in the evening when no one else was around with a bunch of cows. And I went up to the farm gate and looked across the field at the cows. And we know that cows are instinctively curious. So they come up and there were about four or five of them and they start looking and sniffing and licking and all the rest of it. And I wondered on that evening, and I've never really had an answer to the question, do they perceive what is to be their fate? This goes for a lot of animals that we have in our chain for food. Do they understand their place in that? And how do they rationalize that?
Well, look, on a planetary level, yes, they do know. And they know that that's kind of their fate. But I think that the thing that people are not realizing is that it's how it's done. And it's also what their life is like leading up to that point. And this is, you know, this is a very big bone of contention. The animals know that there is too many, we're utilizing too much meat and too many animals, whether it be, you know, fish, cows, sheep or whatever, that we don't need to consume that amount, that we are actually not carnivores, we're, you know, omnivores. And a lot of people are going vegetarian in view of that. But the problem is it's on slaughter day, which it's not always done humanely how it is difficult because the cows behind or the sheep behind, yes, they do know because they're reading the thoughts of the one in front. And this is why you will see a lot of fear, even with the animals outside who can't see the goings on. You will see it in them, you will feel it in them, and people can ignore it if they try to or they want to, but it's there, and the people who work in this industry know that. There's a group of ranchers that are in the US that have been ranching and, you know, sending their animals to slaughter, and they somehow innately felt that this was wrong, and they started to really look into it. And now they are doing videos and they're traveling all around the US in actually sticking up for the animals and saying that, you know, we need to do things differently. That why is the cruelty of farm animals treated different to the cruelty of domestic animals? Why are there different rules and regulations for both? And that is because it suits the human way, because they want to be able to utilize the animals for meat. So yes, the animals are very aware of it, and especially on the day. And it's unfortunately not a very nice thing to think about.
I used to see on roads here in the UK, and I bet you used to see them there too, great truckloads of sheep, for example, all packed into the back of a truck. all looking terribly forlorn, clearly going, well, we know where they were going, and maybe they knew where they were going. I used to think, as I would be overtaking those vehicles, you know, what must they be feeling?
Yeah, what must they be feeling? And being in those horrible, cramped conditions, if we were driving along, Howard, and we saw children or people in that situation, it's the same. It really is. No living creature should be put through that. There's better ways, and, you know, so it's all about money, and it's all about, you know, I mean, they shouldn't be in those cramped conditions. We shouldn't be sending live animals across on ships where a lot of them die and get thrown overboard, and they get sick by the time they get there, all because, you know, it's a certain way, or they want to do it a certain way, or there's more money in it doing it that way. You know, we've got to really look within our hearts and say, you know, do we feel morally correct in doing that? Do we feel right that we can watch all of these chickens on a truck, all crammed in where their feathers are sticking out the sides? They can't even stand up. Is that morally right? Is that right on any sense? Is it humanely right? Is it on any level right?
And there are lots of questions here that are almost political. This is about the pursuance of lots of cheap food. And this is about the pursuance of supermarket chains, maximizing their profits, putting the squeeze on farmers, giving them the minimum returns. These are things that, if we've got any sense, and I'm not sure whether we have, that perhaps, and maybe I'm getting political now and I don't mean to be, but we need to be addressing those questions, don't we?
We do, and I think they are political, because I think you're right. I certainly do have a feeling for the farmers, because, you know, I was brought up on the land myself, and I know that they love the animals and they love the land and they do a lot of things, but it gets to the point monetary-wise where they have no option. And I don't think they like to be put into a corner either. So I think we do need to look at it. I think somebody needs to address it. It's a slow process, and I think it should be really on top of the priority list. Unfortunately, it's not. And that's my role, by, you know, educating and going around and making people aware of the thought processes of animals, and that we can't ignore the fact that they are very aware of what we're doing and what their fate is. And we need to address that, most definitely.
And getting a little metaphysical maybe, but karmically, do you think that by behaving in the way that we're behaving, we are perhaps setting up some trouble for ourselves by unbalancing the way of things in such a way and producing food in a semi-inhumane way like that? Are we storing up on some level somewhere some kind of problems for ourselves? That's a huge question, isn't it?
It is a huge question, but it's really interesting how the general thought process is that if you have killed an animal, you know, which is another living creature on this planet, then you will probably come back as an animal next time and have the same done to you. That is very much, I do believe it is karmic, because we should be loving, compassionate species. We should be a loving, compassionate species. And therefore, I think that ego and, you know, magazines, and girls have got to be a size 8, and, you know, we've got to look a certain way, be a certain way. It's become so materialistic, this planet, that we've lost sight of everything. When people used to be on the land with the indigenous, everybody used to just, the animals used to be respected. They would respect the human. Everybody would live harmoniously. And I think that's what we've lost. And I think that we need to get back to that, because it teaches us to also nurture each other and be very nice to each other. Because, Howard, you would know, you know, it's not just animals. I mean, the murders, the killing on the planet, it's just accelerated. It's gone even beyond the animals. It's to each other now. And I think we need to do a really about face and start to get back to some sort of reality.
Easy to say, isn't it? But very, very difficult to do, especially in an era. You know, I hate this word that is being used all the time, but it's the word of the moment, certainly here in Europe, austerity. It's all about austerity, saving money, trying to rescue the planet from the chaos that various bad decisions caused the international economy back in 2007, 2008, which we're still digging ourselves out of up here. This is going to be a long haul.
It's going to be a long haul, Howard, but I think that people have got to realise that they can do a little bit at a time. I don't want people to see it as, oh, my God, you know, it's such a big issue and what can I do? And, you know, I'm just one person. Look, if you just either donated or did something or in some way, some personal way, honoured the animals or the planet, if every person did one thing, that would already make a difference, because when you were talking about something metaphysical, it's all about consciousness. And if we are changing consciousness, meaning we want to help, meaning we want to put the love back on this planet, you know, for want of a better word, I'm not a very airy-fairy person, I'm a pretty down-to-earth sort of person, but to put the right things back on this planet, we have to start somewhere, and it starts with each person just doing one thing. And if we can do that, we change consciousness. And that's why things are changing in a certain way in certain areas, because consciousness is changing, because our intention is changing. And if you'll notice already, I don't know in the UK, I would imagine it would be the same, but when you buy eggs now, caged eggs, there's always plenty of them, whereas free range, there's few boxes left. So people are trying to promote animal health, at least by going free range or organic, so that the animals at least are treated with respect for that period of time. And that's what they're trying to do, provided that's the truth in the matter.
It is, as we say, an enormous question. And look, I would find it really hard to go vegetarian. I like good vegetable food. You know, look, I live a busy life. I tend to live on microwave meals. I'm not proud of that. But I do eat a certain amount of meat. You know, I like chicken, and I will have the occasional beef burger. You know, I really shouldn't. I know they're bad for me, and I know I need to lose weight and all the rest of it, but life is busy, and I eat meat. I suppose I'm getting round to this question. They sometimes say that plants respond to people, and the plants wince when somebody's cut the grass and they go and water the plants because they know that that person has just committed murder to the grass. We've all heard those stories. If I'd had a beef burger, which occasionally I am partial to, and I went to visit a field full of cows, would they know?
Look, they would, but then animals don't really hold it against you like that. You know, oh, he's a meat eater, don't let him in the field. yes, they would, because they know what energy is in your body, especially if you'd only taken it a very short time before. Do you know what I mean? They can reckon, like, that is the energy of your body. And yes, they do. But as I say, Howard, it is a big thing to say to every race on the planet, okay, just stop eating meat and stop eating fish. Right, everybody on the planet, let's just stop. That would be great, but let's be realistic. That's not going to happen anytime soon. So what I would say to people is, if you're going to eat meat, then it's our responsibility to make sure that the practice of those animals that are being used for food are done in the most respectful and high way. They are fed the proper food. They are given the proper respect. They are given the appropriate land size and everything to make them comfortable for their time there. And when the time comes that it is done humanely, and there are much better ways of doing it than the way we're doing it, and we can at least take that step first, Howard. So then it's not such a sticky issue for people, because I know it is. I know a lot of people don't want to give up meat, so they don't want to go listen to a talk from a vegetarian or anything about vegetarian. So how about this? How about if we are going to eat meat on this planet, then let's take the necessary steps and make the laws that the animals are protected to that degree. Let's make that first step.
Recently, you may know, I interviewed Duncan Rhodes from Nexus Magazine, an Australian, and he mentioned you, and that's why I'm in contact with you, because he fired up my brain to get in touch with you again after 10 years. He told me a story about how you worked with his dog. His dog was dying, and you communicated the fact that the dog really did want to go because the dog's work was done. But the interesting thing about it, as Duncan told the story, was that you also communicated with the dog after it had died, or he or she had died. Talk to me about that.
Look, as you would know with anything, energy stays. Only our physical body dies. The actual essence of us stays. So communicating telepathically with a live animal is very similar to communicating with an animal that has passed over. It's still, the energy is there, the essence is there. It is still, you're still able to contact that animal, and it doesn't have to be just a week after or 2 weeks after, it can be any length of time at all. So that's where that concept is, that everything is reachable. I guess like, you know, the John Edwards around and the people who are mediums can contact your relatives after the fact. It's a similar principle, but for me it's just a telepathic connection.
Right. But, you know, it was quite remarkable because the way Duncan told it, you communicated with the dog in the next life and the dog was there to school and help and teach dogs that were due to come here on what life would be like here and what their role in the scheme of things would be.
Well, that's right. And, you know, when you communicate with them on the other side, they don't just sit in hammocks or on dog. They're not really a dog. Duncan's gorgeous girl, female dog, was she was just in a dog's body this lifetime, but she's just another being. And on the other side, she does have a role, and she does work with those type of energies to get them back down here on the planet, but they all have different roles. And some of them work with souls that have been quite traumatized down here. Some of them, you know, are like philosophers. They download, a bit like a USB, really. They download information. They've shown me all sorts of roles, and we'll have a role when we go back there, Howard. So everybody is, it is quite remarkable what you can find out and where they actually go afterwards. We had an afterlife conference here in Australia, and they asked me to speak on the animals because people wanted to know where their animals went, like what happened afterwards and all of that sort of thing. So I had a very interesting story of this will actually be quite good, you being in the UK, but I'll change the names to protect the people. But I was communicating with the dog, a dog that had passed, and I said to this dog, they want to know what you're doing on the other side and this and that. And I said, can you give me any, you know, really detailed information? And anyway, the dog said, gave me two names, and the name was... Les and Duncan, will say. And anyway, I said, okay. So when I spoke to the people, they were on the phone, they were on speakerphone, and I said, look, your dog has given me two names, and that your dog has assured me you'll know who these names are, and the name is Les and Duncan. Anyway, they went a little bit quiet, and they said, do you know Prince Harry and Prince William? And I said, well, not personally, no. And they said, but you know the story of Prince Harry, how they often talk about Hewitt being his father. You know, it's always been a bit of a controversial type thing. And anyway, Alison, who was married to the guy Jeremy, she said, well, you see, Les is actually his mother. Her name's Leslie, but we always call her Les. And I said, well, what about the Duncan? She said, well, that's his so-called biological father's best friend. But we've always wondered, because he looks exactly like him, has the same mannerisms, and has been in the family for years. And that was told to me by the dog. And I said, well, you might want to take a paternity test. So they just sat there, and no other names were mentioned. Just those two.
So not only does your dog know its name, his or her name, it knows your family names and a few other things as well.
Yes, it does. And to give me that bit of information was proof in itself, was that I was indeed getting messages from the other side.
Certainly sounds like it. Oh, boy. And also, the moral of the story, I guess, should be, from all that we've said, you should be nice to the animals, because if you're not nice to the animals, you might find yourself coming back as one.
Yes, and in a very compromising situation, Howard, and not such a good situation. Well, so we should be great to the animals anyway, and we should take this opportunity and learn from them and become more like them, and we'll just be better people.
There's a photograph of you online, just finally here at the end, with your cat. And you seem to have a very close bond with your cat. In fact, I think I heard a meow. It may not have been in the middle of this recording, but you do seem to have a connection with that cat.
Yes, and that is the cat that was meowing, Howard. I did put her out for you because she was getting louder and louder and right next to the microphone, because she will not be upstaged. And her name is Mattie. And the cat that I spoke to you about in the beginning, Beau, well, Mattie is his sister. And when Bo passed away, Maddie actually communicated with me and actually explained to me how the communication works. And it's through her that I've been able to keep hone my skills and have been doing a wonderful business here in Australia. So it's all due to her. So I'm glad we're making mention of her, because I know she'll mention it to me after this recording.
No, I just had a feeling that she wanted to be part of this broadcast, and I was absolutely right by the sounds of it.
You should be an animal communicator, Howard.
Lovely to talk with you, Tricia, and let's not leave it 10 years next time. Keep in touch, and I'll put you on here again. I'd love to talk again.
Oh, wonderful. And it's been an absolute privilege. Thank you so much, Howard.
And give my love to one of my favourite places on earth. And I'm not sure how I'll be able to do it, but I've got this list of places I must return to before my time is done. And WA and Perth are on that list.
Well, I'd look forward to you coming here so I can actually catch up with you personally face-to-face. That would be absolutely wonderful.
That would be great. I'd love to stay in Fremantle and just have breakfast once more on the Cappuccino Strip.
Absolutely. One of the most amazing places in Perth. We have a lot of UK people here, Howard.
I know you do. It seems that when I was there, it seemed that not only is it the cleanest place that I've seen around the world, you could almost eat your dinner off the pavements there, it seemed to me. Maybe I didn't see enough of it, but that was what I saw. But every other person I spoke to was a Brit.
Look, just about. I actually live in the northern part of Perth, and as I said, I'm right by the beach. I see the beach from my office, which is wonderful. And the Brits here, I mean, this suburb is really South Africans, Brits and Australians. That's the whole, wherever you go, there's just so many British people here. And so it's great.
Well, we used to have a TV newscaster who was quite well known sort of in the 70s called Gordon Honeycomb. And Gordon Honeycomb went to retire in Perth. So that was one of the stories I was told. There are lots of Brits there. Tricia, lovely to talk with you again. Please give your website so that people can find out more about you.
It's animaltalk.com.au.
And it's morning time here in UK, Tricia, and it's evening time where you, so have a great evening. Thank you again.
You too. Thanks, Howard.
The Amazing Thoughts of Tricia McKay. I'll put a link to her website on my website, theunexplained.tv. Our website, designed, created, honed and maintained by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you very much for being on this journey with me. We're going to do big things. We're starting to do that now. The show is growing enormously. Thank you very much. Please keep the emails coming. Keep the contributions coming and keep your support coming. And until next we meet here on The Unexplained, please stay safe, stay calm and stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. And until next time we do this, take care and bye-bye.